The text for tonight's sermon is Genesis chapter 37. This is on page 36 of the Church Bibles. Genesis chapter 37 on page 36. Starting to read at verse 1. Jacob lived in the land of his father's sojournings, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his sons, because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a robe of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. Now Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Hear this dream that I have dreamed. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright. And behold, your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf." His brothers said to him, "Are you indeed to reign over us? Or are you indeed to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Then he dreamed another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Behold, I have dreamed another dream. Behold, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me." But when he told it to his father and to his brothers, his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to bow ourselves to the ground before you?" And his brothers were jealous of him. But his father kept the saying in mind. Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." And he said to him, "Here I am." So he said to him, "Go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring me word." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem, and a man found him wandering in the fields. And the man asked him, "What are you seeking?" "I am seeking my brothers," he said. "Tell me, please, where they are, pasturing the flock." And the man said, "They have gone away, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. They saw him from afar, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams." But when Reuben heard it, he rescued him out of their hands, saying, "Let us not take his life." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood. Cast him into this pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him," that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the robe of many colors that he wore. And they took him and cast him into the pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. Then they sat down to eat. And looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. Then Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. They took Joseph to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes and returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is gone, and I, where shall I go?" Then they took Joseph's robe and slaughtered a goat and dipped the robe in the blood. And they sent the robe of many colors and brought it to their father and said, "This we have found. Please identify whether it is your son's robe or not." And he identified it and said, "It is my son's robe. A fierce animal has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his garments and put on sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son for many days. All his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, "No, I shall go down to Sheol with my son mourning." Thus his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him to Egypt, to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard.
Alice, thank you very much indeed for reading for us. May I add my welcome to you, very warm welcome, especially if this is your first visit here at St. Helens, a time of year when people do arrive with us for the first time, and if this is your first visit amongst us, a very warm welcome indeed. Over the last two Saturdays, I've had the mixed fortune of being introduced to the BBC, is it BBC series, Any Dream Will Do. I was going to qualify it as paralysingly cringeworthy, but it occurred to me one of you may have been the kind of originators of the series, and therefore I ought to be a little more cautious. Watching it comes from a combination of having teenage children and no friends. And therefore, on a Saturday evening, I have to say I'm now rather sort of hooked. But I feel I need to say that it is by complete coincidence that we are running an 11-week series on Sunday nights here at St. Helens. I don't think it was that the BBC had been studying our term card as they sought to select a Joseph for Andrew Lloyd Webber's next West End musical. We're going to spend 11 weeks looking at Genesis 37 to 50, and we're going to go into some depth on Joseph's life. And we're going to see that quite categorically the hero of this story is not Joseph. The hero is not even Jacob, whose family story it is. It is really God. And the reason we have the account of Jacob's family in the Bible is to show us how it is that God keeps his promise to raise up a people from every nation, every tribe, every tongue, every language, to enjoy his perfect land of promise, what is ultimately his new creation. You may be familiar that every section of Genesis is introduced with the phrase that we see there in chapter 37, verse 2, "These are the generations of." And in the major sections, the generations of Abraham, the generations of Isaac, the generations of Jacob, we find major lessons for God's people in this foundational book, given to God's people as they make their way to the promised land. So Moses told and recorded these stories for God's people as they made their way from the land of Egypt into the promised land. And therefore, each generation, each family, have a particular slant on the lesson, how it is God is going to bring his people into his promised land. A particular angle. Now, there are two different ways of handling a piece of what's called narrative like this, history like this, in these 14 chapters. So really, there are just a couple of really big points running through all 14 chapters. And so one way of handling it would be to read the whole story tonight and come back next week and look at the two major lessons and then move on to something completely different. Go off to look at Acts or something like that. Alternatively, we could recognize that these chapters were given to God's people as they moved from slavery in Egypt to the Promised Land, and they were intended to be told and retold and told again. And you know what it's like with a family story. You get to the familiar bits. You know the punchline. You know the big lessons. And all the way through, as the family story is told and retold and told again. Now, any familiar, you're kind of nudging each other. You say, yeah, we know in just a moment. You must have family stories like that in your own family or amongst your own friends. I mean, when our family gets together, the story is almost always told of how the donkey who was in the back of our family estate car broke loose and made his way into the front seat and ended up smashing the driving seat so that he had the driving wheel between his legs like that, and my father was left just holding the three prongs. And, you know, you can tell the story and you know, but all the way through there's kind of knowing winks around the table, or the time my mother shot my horse, or the time. There are a number of family stories that you're bound to have like that. I'm still in therapy for it. And as you go through the familiar bits, you know the punchline, but each part is adding to the punchline and you're seeing a different aspect of it. Now, how much more with the family history of God's people? For the big themes and the big lessons we are learning are big themes of God's character. And because the family story is told in such detail, and it's so vivid, we're going to find week on week on week that we find these two or three major themes shown to us in tremendous real life technicolor. And we're going to see different aspects of these big themes and different angles on the big themes. So that as we are making our journey to God's promised land, his new creation, we can say, yeah, these two or three big lessons, yes, yeah, we can see how it applies in this circumstance or that circumstance or the other circumstance, which is why I'm so thrilled we're spending 11 weeks on this fantastic part of the Bible. Well, I think this opening chapter introduces us to the major big themes. And the first is that Joseph is God's man. There's no doubt that Joseph is highly favoured, is there, by his father Jacob. You could say he's Jacob's man. Rachel was Jacob's favourite wife. He had to wait 7 years before he was allowed to marry, 7 years and a week before he was allowed to marry her. And then he had to serve his father-in-law for another 7 years before he was able to leave her family home. At first, of course, Jacob couldn't have children with Rachel. And therefore, there were 10 brothers born before Joseph came along. 6 of them to Leah, Rachel's sister. 2 of them to Bilhah, Rachel's home help. And 2 more to Zilpah, Leah's au pair or cleaning lady or whatever you want to call her. We won't go into the details of that. It's a pretty murky business, all of that bit. And we looked at it last year. Finally, after the 10 other brothers came Joseph and then Benjamin. Of course, Rachel died in childbirth when Benjamin was born. So Joseph and Benjamin, the two sons of Jacob's favorite wife, were very, very precious to him. And we can see that stated up front, can't we, in verse 3. Now, Israel, that's Jacob's other name, loved Joseph more than any other of his sons because he was the son of his old age. And Israel made Joseph a robe of many colours. The robe of many colours was actually a robe of, well, later in the Bible, it's a robe of royalty, of special favour. In the only other place in the Bible where it's mentioned, it's what's worn by a princess's, a king's daughter, a princess. It has long sleeves. And it's a kind of billabong beach robe affair of many colours. I think billabong is a sort of upmarket fashion house, isn't it? Is that right? Can you have an upmarket fashion house from Australia? I suppose you probably can. Anyway, that's what I think it is. So there's no doubt that Joseph is Jacob's favoured son. But the dreams show us, and I think that's why we get them right up front here in the account, that Joseph was much more than just a family favourite. Dreams in the book of Genesis are very significant indeed. They're understood to be God's way of communicating to his people. Before God had given us his full and final revelation in Jesus Christ, dreams were the way that God spoke to his people and pointed towards the coming of Christ. And God would then give interpretations to his people. And you can see that from the first two references, which I've had printed out on the back of the notice sheet, where it's made very plain, in Joseph's words, actually, do not interpretations belong to God? God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do through these two dreams later on to Pharaoh, that dreams are God's way of speaking. Indeed, when you got the same dream twice, it was confirmation of what God had revealed. So you can see Joseph say that in the third of the references I jotted down. The doubling of Pharaoh's dream means that the thing is fixed by God. Now Joseph has these two dreams. A sheaf was the stalks of corn. I don't know if you mean it. When we're in the middle of London, it's hard to explain this, isn't it, in 2007. But I can even remember sheaves on our farm way back. And before combines started coming down to Cornwall. And you collected together the stalks of corn into a big sheaf, and then they were taken off to the thrasher. And it's harvest time, and Joseph has collected his sheaf, and the brothers have collected theirs. And Joseph's had this dream, and he said, in the dream, all your 11 sheaves came and bowed down to mine. And the brothers realize exactly what's going on. Look at verse 8. Are you indeed to reign over us? Are you indeed to rule over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and his words. And the doubling of the dream serves simply to confirm the point. We move from the agricultural to the astrophysical. And this time, his parents are involved too, to make it even more sort of significant. The stakes are higher. And Jacob gets the point, verse 10. Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to bow ourselves to the ground before you? Nothing could be more clear. Here is a statement by God, rightly shared with his brothers, surely by Joseph, because when God speaks, it's absolutely right that you make the revelation clear, that God was going to raise Joseph up as God's man to a position where all his family will bow in reverence before him. So now, there is a way, isn't there, of reading these verses that paints Joseph out to be a rather self-important, jumped-up twerp who strutted his stuff in his Armani unisex suit. You probably heard, I think that's how Andrew Lloyd Webber interprets Joseph. I mean, he wouldn't have a clue, I don't suppose, what Joseph's really all about. But I think that is to totally misunderstand what's going on. There's no comment from the author to suggest that Joseph is a self-important upstart. He's righteous above his brothers, isn't he? He's spoken to by God, he's given this revelation, and surely, quite rightly, he goes and tells his brother what God has said. It's confirmed to him by repetition. Indeed, by the end of the account, we find Jacob describing Joseph as, quote, set apart from his brothers, quote, the shepherd, the rock of Israel, and Moses describes Joseph as the prince among his brothers. He is God's man. And that's the point of these dreams, to show us that this is God's chosen man, that here is God's person who God is going to use to bring about God's purposes for God's people. Now let's plug that into the context of the whole letter. Because we have to realize that this family is no ordinary family. This is a family specially chosen by God for the prime purpose of bringing about God's promises to rescue a people to belong to God and to take them to his promised land and establish them in his promised land forever and to be a blessing to all nations. That's what this family is all about. It's been about this since Genesis 12. We haven't got time to go back there now. But back there, God promised that he would multiply this family. and that he'd make this family a blessing to all nations, and that he'd give this family a place in his presence in his precious promised land. And now we're seeing God identifying Joseph as the man through whom he will keep his promise to his people, a man before whom all his people will bow in humble reverence, a man who is God's man to achieve God's purposes. Now, anybody who knows anything about Jesus Christ will be beginning to say, hey, I think I see something vaguely familiar here. But before we go there, I want to say one other little comment and to present you with a little bit of a dilemma. It is possible that Joseph is meant right from the early stages to be a kind of Jesus, a type of Christ, pointing us to God's ultimate man, Jesus Christ. And that may be right, and I haven't made up my mind quite yet. And so over the next 11 weeks, one of the things we need to be asking ourselves is it right that this Joseph is a kind of Christ, a type of Christ, where God is using Joseph and acting in Joseph in the kind of way that he's going to act in Jesus ultimately? We see that in Moses. We see that in King David. We see that in the rest of the Bible. Or is it just that we are seeing some principles here about the way that God works to rescue and preserve his people and to keep his promises, about the character of God that we will see repeated over and over again? One of those two things. They're very close, in fact. But the key point is that Joseph is God's man, and he's God's man who has been taken by God, raised up by God, to bring about God's promises, to bless the nations, to rescue his people, the man before whom all people ultimately will bow. Now, that means that our 11-week series is going to be completely unlike Any Dream Will Do, which is the BBC series. Right up front, I need to say to you, you could not be Joseph. Because Joseph is God's specially chosen man, who's been selected by God to bring about, it seems, the rescue of God's people. And we're told that right up front. So you could not be Joseph in that sense. Similarly, we don't have to spend 11 painstaking weeks of viewing, watching Graham Norton and Andrew Lloyd Webber week after week, wringing our hands and watching what are inevitably vote-rigged telephone votes going through the BBC and eventually being, oh, so surprised when whoever it is happens to be Joseph. We know who God's man is right up from the beginning. And therefore, every week we need to be saying to ourselves, this is God's man. How is it that God operates through his man as he goes about rescuing and redeeming and keeping and preserving his people? And of course, it's great to have this after Easter, isn't it? Because we know as Christians that God has a man. In whichever way Joseph might point forward to Jesus, God has identified his man already, the one who was nailed to a cross, who was raised up from the dead, who is enthroned in heaven, who is now calling people from every nation and every tribe to be part of his eternal kingdom. God has a man, the man, the Lord Jesus Christ. God's man. Second theme that we're going to see as we kind of tee up the series is that Joseph's brothers are wicked men. And the point here, I have to say, has been the point that has spoken to me most powerfully this week. And this is the point that has been of greatest personal encouragement in the last 7 days. As I've seen what I think we're being taught here, that it always is the way that God's man will be opposed and hated and despised and rejected by wicked men. Did you notice in Jacob's family that we have one of the most dysfunctional and despicable families? You know, if you had to make a soap of this lot, you know, it would look anything you see on telly like The Archers, on the radio like The Archers, positively kind of normal. So there is favoritism, isn't there? The favoritism of Jacob. There is hatred. Three times we're told. Verse 4, they hated him. Verse 5, they hated him even more. Verse 8, they hated him. There is a bitter internecine warfare, as the brothers will not even speak peacefully to him. So every sentence carries a kind of snide barb or a wounding arrow. There is jealousy, verse 11. His brothers were jealous of him. There is plotting as Joseph makes the journey on foot up to Dothan. There's weakness, isn't there? You know, Reuben, he's the eldest. He ought to stand up and stop all this nonsense. But Reuben's just weak. And he does this underhand little way of putting him in a pit and coming back some later point. It's real weakness from the one who's supposed to be the leader. And then there's Judah, who pathetically sells him. And then there's the callous indifference. Do you know, later in the story, we're told that the brothers saw the distress of Joseph as he begged them, and they wouldn't listen. Can you imagine Joseph down in the pit, calling out for help? And what do the brothers do? They just go and have a meal. And then you can imagine Joseph being led, bound by his hands, staggering along behind the camel or whatever it was he'd been dragged behind. He said, don't forget me, don't leave me behind. There's callous indifference. There's attempted murder, there's deception. There's utter hypocrisy as they try and comfort their father. I mean, that's wretched, isn't it? They just attempted to murder him and sold him into slavery, and then they come round and put their arm around their dad's shoulder and say, oh, well, never mind, old boy. You know, cheer up. And then there's the unresolved grief. It is an utterly dysfunctional family. But it isn't so much the dysfunction of the family that is the interest and the point, I think, here. And the rest of the Bible picks it up. I want you to turn to Acts chapter 7, if you would. It's page 1103. 1102, in fact, 1102. Acts chapter 7 and verse 9. Page 1102, Acts chapter 7, verse 9. The patriarchs, that's Joseph's brothers, jealous of Joseph, sold him into Egypt. But God was with him and rescued him out of all his afflictions and gave him favor and wisdom before Pharaoh, king of Egypt, who made him ruler over Egypt, over all of his household. Now look forward to verse 51. What Stephen does in this speech is he then goes on and identifies group after group after group who've rejected God's chosen men. And then verse 51, you stiff-necked people, uncircumcised in heart and ears, you always resist the Holy Spirit. As your fathers did, so do you. Which of the prophets did your fathers not persecute and kill? And they killed those who announced beforehand the coming of the righteous one, and so on. So it's interesting, isn't it, that when we come to the New Testament, the only thing really that is picked up about the Joseph narrative is that the brothers behaved just as God's enemies always behave all the way through the Bible. Just as it is the repeated theme that runs right the way through the Bible, that God will raise up his man to rescue and preserve his people, so it is a repeated theme through the Bible that God's man will always be hated and opposed by wicked, jealous men. And once we see it repeated over and over again through the Bible. Stephen charts example after example after example, and he finally comes to Jesus Christ. And of course, Jesus is clearly God's man with all of God's authority to bring about all of God's promises, and yet those who saw him hated him. Is this not Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we knew, they said? He is clearly God's ruler before whom every knee will one day bow, and yet they despised him. They said, surely his power is from Beelzebub, the devil. He is clearly the man whom God has appointed for rescue, and yet those to whom he came would not receive him. They rejected him. They plotted evil against him. No one who had power to preserve him acted in strength, but in weakness they handed him over. They mocked him and spat on him. They made a fake crown of thorns and crashed it down onto his head with their stick. and ultimately they crucified him. So this second major theme identifies for us a major theme that runs through the story and runs through the whole of the Bible, that wicked men will stand against and plot against jealously and deceitfully God's man all the way through the history of God's dealings with his people. I want to say that's been an enormous help to me over this week. I've got to the stage and the age now, the tender age of mid-40s, that I've started to read the columnists in the broadsheets. I'm sure some of you have been doing it since you were three, but I always thought it was rather a dull thing to do until the last 10 years or so. And over the last few weeks, there have been a number of columns in the broadsheets and one in the Spectator, which you really aren't allowed to read till you're over 70. I borrowed it off my dad, honest. Which have been quite vitriolic about Christians and the Christian faith. I mean, Matthew Paris, no thinking person could ever be a Christian. Deeply antagonistic. I mean, he's got a reason to be, because of a practicing homosexual, he's got cause not to want Jesus to be right. Rod Liddell in The Spectator, full of caustic criticism. The pressure from the militant atheists is relentless in the press. But it's not just the militant atheists, it's also there in Church of England politics. I was at a meeting this week, and just before Easter, where I was told, by a senior bishop in the Church of England, you're never going to find a Bible-believing bishop in the Church of England who's prepared to stand up and stand out for biblical truth. It's just too costly. Now, that man was a Bible-believing Christian, and he has made strong efforts to do that. And then there's the denial of central Orthodox teaching that we saw before Easter, as a dean of one of our cathedrals denied the central teaching of the cross of Christ. And it's possible in those circumstances, I don't know about you, maybe you're impervious, the discouragement that comes as you see the tidal wave of opposition to Jesus Christ, God's man, whether from the religious or from the militant atheists. And I find myself, I have to say, coming back from a delightful holiday in the West Country, feeling to myself that it's like coming back to the front line. And in the last 7 days, this passage has been of enormous encouragement to me, as I've realized that it has always been the way that wicked men have hated God's man, God's chosen king, Jesus. Whether it's Joseph or Jesus, wicked men have always stood against hatred, jealousy, deception, the war of words. We see all these things in these chapters. Callous indifference, pathetic failure to do what is right. Oh, we couldn't possibly stand up for what is true. It's just too costly. Shame of not doing what ought to be done. Hypocrisy. And maybe it's rather perverse, but I have found it enormously encouraging to know that it is the norm that God's chosen man, Joseph in this case, Jesus, and then those who stand with Jesus will be opposed. I don't know what it's like for you in your office. I mean, maybe it's just hunky-dory. And everybody in your office says, oh, it's wonderful you're a Christian. How marvelous. Come and talk to me about it. Maybe you've never heard a word spoken about Jesus Christ in your hall of residence. Or maybe you're the only Christian in your school and actually everybody thinks it's wonderful and they're queuing up outside your door and asking to find out about it. I doubt it very, very much. And my expectation is you, like every other person who stood with Jesus down through the centuries, is well aware of the tidal wave of opposition. And in chapter 37 of Genesis, we see that has always been the way as people have stood against God's man. Very important. You know, some of us, unless Jesus returns, will be around for 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years. I guess some of you have still been knocking in. The way they keep people alive now till they're over 90. You might be here for another 80 years, some of you. And over that course, you are going to face maybe 5 years, maybe a decade of real opposition, personally, maybe corporately. And unless we learn this lesson that was taught to God's people as they made their way from Egypt to the promised land, that wicked men will always oppose God's purposes, unless we're clear on that, we will be too naive and gullible to be of any use. It's a great encouragement to know that that has always happened. And finally, the really big lesson, which we will just touch on before we close, is that God is sovereign in bringing about his gracious and good promises through his chosen man and through the sinful actions of wicked men. Did you hear that? I don't think you really listened to that. God is sovereign in bringing about his purposes through his chosen man and through the sinful actions of wicked men. Did you hear that? God acts sovereignly in all of these actions, despicably wicked and gloriously righteous, to bring about his purposes. He uses the actions of the wicked brothers so that he is in charge as they hate. He is in charge as they refuse to speak to Joseph. He is in charge as they express their jealousy. He is in charge as they plot. He is in charge as they vacillate and weakly fail to do the right thing. He is in charge as they go for the money rather than what should be done. He is in charge as they are callously indifferent, hypocritical, and deceitful. And he uses all of these things to bring about his perfect plan of rescuing his people and bringing the nations to bow before his feet. Now, we're going to have 11 weeks on it, 10 more weeks on this. So there's lots of time to talk it through and question time and so on. But by the end of this story, the people are multiplied in number. They've begun to be a blessing to the nations. The nations actually have bowed down to Joseph. We see everybody coming to Joseph. We see the brothers bowing down to Joseph by the end. And all of these things have been possible as God has sovereignly used the wicked actions of the evil brothers to bring about his gracious purposes. And surely that is why we're told these dreams up front. You see, by giving us the two dreams up front, God is saying to us right up front, note, this is my man. And everything that is happening in this chapter and every chapter that succeeds it is right in the grip of my hand. I'm in charge. And because by the end we see God's man triumph, we're able to say, God's in charge. God's in charge both as the righteous conduct their life and as the wicked plot against him. And he uses all these things in his extraordinary sovereignty to bring about his purposes. Conclusion. How do you respond? Well, I think humility. You know, that's been one of the things for me. Let me talk to you first, if you're like one of the brothers. I mean, in a room this size, there are bound to be some who hate Jesus. There are bound to be some who resist Jesus Christ. And if you resist Jesus Christ and he's God's man, then you're resisting God. You hate God. And this chapter and this story will, I hope, bring you to a point of humility before ultimately you have to bow to Jesus, whether you like it or not. It ought to, because you'll see here that the wicked plotting of sinful men counts for absolutely nothing in terms of overthrowing God. Matthew Paris can write as many articles, actually, it's hopelessly inconsistent, and he never, ever comes to deal with the historical facts of Jesus. I think he must be frightened of it, actually. He never, ever deals with the facts. He always deals with caricature. So the militant atheist will shake his fist at God, but these chapters should bring the militant atheist to a position of humility as they realize that they can spit and shout and kick the traces, but they'll never achieve. In fact, God will take their efforts and use them to his own glory. Humility. But also, what about you, Christian? You know, I was challenged this week because I think there is a kind of pride in the self-pity
that says, I'm the only one left and everybody else seems to be on the other side. As if it all depends on me and as if, you know, I'm sort of to pity myself. But actually, even as Joseph finds himself under the cosh, God is absolutely in charge. And he will not allow any of these events, however discouraging and disappointing, to thwart his purposes. Humility, courage. Well, the ordering of all events to achieve his purposes by God should give us great courage to be bold. They can hate you in your office and in your school for talking about Jesus Christ. But you are on the winning side. And nothing will thwart God and his purposes. And therefore great encouragement. Let's pray together, shall we? Above all else, our Father, we praise you that you raise up your man and that in Jesus Christ you have raised up the one who has conquered death, has paid the price for sin, risen from the grave, ascended to heaven, enthroned, and calling people from every tribe and nation and language across the world and down through time to worship him. Thank you that we're just part of a thousand upon thousand, million upon million of believers. And thank you that one day every knee will bow to Jesus Christ, some reluctantly and facing his final judgment, and others in joy and gladness. We praise you that nothing can thwart that, that you are in absolute control. We ask that you would give us courage to stand with Jesus Christ and be counted with him. For we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.